Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Monday, August 11th, and August 11th means that it is my mom's birthday. So for all of you who know and love my mom, Valerie Ellis, who's a special guest on this program quite frequently, actually, we wish her a very happy birthday today, and I'll get to go and see my parents actually next week. Looking forward to that visit. And for a lot of you, your kids are going back to school today, and this coming as one of the greatest headlines that I read this week: Oklahoma America First test designed to keep woke teachers from blue states out of classrooms. So the Sooner State is compiling a new test aimed at keeping woke teachers from Democrat states out of its public schools. This is coming from Reed Lyon. State Superintendent Ryan Walters is poised to reveal the test this month, which will be for teachers who move to Oklahoma from blue states such as New York and California. Walters told Fox News teachers from both red and blue states have moved there after the state offered the largest signing bonuses for teachers in the country, with up to $50,000 for teachers ranked in the top 10% nationwide. But high-ranking doesn't mean they're immune from leftist views. So State Superintendent Ryan Walters joins us now. And Ryan, you just keep banging out the wins. I mean, this is a great test and a way to make sure that teachers are teaching what they should be instead of woke indoctrination. So what is this test designed to provide?
Well, I appreciate that very much, Jenna, and thanks for having me on. Look, I mean, what we saw with Gavin Newsom's most recent announcement of, mandating in the teacher training and in the classrooms that they have to teach gender confusion, we started looking deeper at what is being required from teachers in these blue states. And again, when you bring them into a red state, are they willing to teach your standards? Are they willing to teach the values that the people of Oklahoma want? And so the test is going to focus on two things that we've seen in these blue states. The first is basic biology. In our standards, it's very clear. There are biological differences between men and women. This isn't a tough one. But if they can't come in here and pass a test on what is a woman and explain that there are biological differences and that's how they will teach it, they're not going to teach in Oklahoma. The second one is a basic understanding of American government. It will be very similar to the citizenship test. So they will take a civics test, too, to make sure they understand American values. And by the way, we make all of our teachers here in Oklahoma, when you go into the classroom, take a civics test as well, because we want to make sure of that. But especially from these blue states where they have just been teaching this hatred for America and just the lies about American history, we want to make sure that, again, we're creating good citizens in the classroom, patriotic students in the classroom. So we're going to make sure that as we bring in the best teachers from across the country, we're not allowing any of Gavin Newsom's woke indoctrinators in as well.
That's excellent. And no one should be teaching children anything if they can't understand the biological difference between a man and a woman. I mean, that's the average, 2 and 3 year old, like my nephews, when they were two, they understood that there is a difference between boys and girls. And so if teachers can't come in and say that, then it indicates something that's deeper than, obviously not understanding it. It's an ideology difference. And so I think that's really smart to ask them that question, because you know that they know the difference. It's whether or not they're willing to express the truth and express the truth about biology and not go along with the woke indoctrination. Because during Ketanji Brown Jackson's hearing and her nomination confirmation hearing as a justice, it was shocking, I think, to a lot of people that she was unwilling to say that, because she said, well, I'm not a biologist. And for a lot of people, that made her unfit to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. I think we've seen that. And so in your view then, and I think this is correct, it would make a teacher unfit to then teach in Oklahoma.
That's right. So, and I think what's really important is, first of all, remember when we came into office, I changed our standards. So I changed our history standards and science standards to be very explicit of what will be taught in the classroom. I wanted to be very specific so parents understood this is what is to be taught or not. If you come into our classrooms, you are going to teach to those standards. You don't get to come in and go teach 27 genders and go teach critical race theory. No, you don't. And so it is very clear in our standards. There's two genders. There's biological differences between those. And we have our history standards as well. And again, to put the teachers on the spot right out of the gate and go, listen, you're coming from a state that required you to teach there were 27 genders. So we're going to make sure that we understand these are the standards here and these are how these will be taught. I think it's essential. I think every state should be doing it. Again, you should have great standards like our history standards in Oklahoma, but you also have to ensure that, again, these leftist teachers, especially, when you see what the National Teachers Union is pushing, hey, they're going to come in and try to do their own thing. So you need to make sure that you're holding individuals accountable so the parents can know that they're going to get a good product in the classroom when they send their kids back to school.
Yeah, and the same goes for the second part of assessing the knowledge of the U.S. Constitution and an understanding of American exceptionalism. This is really important, as you mentioned. Superintendent Ryan Walters, my special guest this morning with this this test for teachers in Oklahoma. This matters because we're teaching here in America, and so we want to make sure that teachers are not only aligned with reality and truth, but also aligned with the founding of America and understanding what makes our country great and raising good citizens. I mean, this is the whole emphasis and focus. It's not just about being able to pass a test. It's about a deeper understanding. So how does the test actually accomplish that in terms of not just listing off, some important dates in U.S. history, for example, but actually getting to the root of the worldview of the teacher?
Excellent question. And by the way, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think, listen, absolutely, our schools are there to make sure that kids understand the basics, reading, writing, and math. Absolutely, we want kids to be able to use their God-given talents to get a great job. But also, when you look back historically, why do we have schools? One of the biggest reasons is to create good citizens that can continue our Republican form of government so that we can continue to have a constitutional republic in this country. That is one of the key reasons for having an education system set up the way that it was here in this country. And so, yeah, what we do is our focus is on, do they understand the way that the government is set up, and do they understand the Declaration of Independence and the principles espoused there? Do they understand how the Constitution set up the American form of government and why? Because, again, when you're talking about anything in a classroom with kids, everything should be centered around, again, creating good citizens that understand this country, our background, and frankly, what makes us exceptional. And so it starts with an understanding of where did our rights derive from, what the founders say about that. And then secondly, how did they actually set up government to protect those core principles and make sure they continue? So it's very heavily focused on some of those primary documents to make sure they understand the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, the form of government that it sets up.
Yeah. And so is this test then written or is this more of like a designated interview? Because how would you tell the difference between someone who came in from a blue state and maybe they are hearing about this and they know they have to pass this test, and so they'll go through and say what they need to get into the classroom, but then or pass the test, but then they're really not focused on following through on that?
No, great question. So, yeah, no, it is actually a test. So they will have to take the test. But then secondly, what we do here in Oklahoma is I have accrediting bodies that go in and check to ensure that the standards are being taught, to make sure that what teachers are doing is actually being done. So number two, we do check that. And lastly, what we did is when I first came into office, we set up what was called an awareity system, where any parent, any student, any teacher in the state can send us complaints or any issues they're having, and we deal with it immediately. They get to track the progress of the solution to their problem. And so the reality is, anytime we get a complaint that a teacher is not teaching to the standards, is pushing indoctrination, we immediately investigate that. So we have the ability, no matter where you are in the state, again, parent, teacher, or child, you can turn in the complaints to us, and we immediately begin investigating to make sure that that's what's going on. And I think, listen, with what you've seen from the National Teachers Union, from what you've seen from some of these radicals that have masqueraded as teachers, I think we absolutely have to stay on top of this. And luckily for us, parents have been tremendous in giving us that feedback so we can go in and hold those individuals accountable.
And I'm speaking with Superintendent Ryan Walters from the great state of Oklahoma that's being made even greater because of people like him. And you're one of my heroes, Ryan, for standing up just so firmly in the Christian worldview and what America was founded on, and using this position to ensure that kids are actually getting the education that they deserve rather than this woke indoctrination. And so this test is designed specifically so that woke teachers from blue states aren't coming in and kind of infiltrating. Is Oklahoma planning to designate which blue states then have teachers coming in that then would be eligible for this test? Or is it just, even if you're from a red state, you know, any teacher coming into Oklahoma from outside will have to take it?
Great question. So right now what we're looking at are blue states that have in their standards or requirement trainings something that goes definitively against what we require. So that's where California and New York were the first two that caught our mind of, like, literally what is being required of them in the classroom to teach on gender. If you taught that in Oklahoma, you wouldn't be able to continue teaching. So that's why what we're looking at is what are states actually requiring. And so that's where we're starting. And so that's kind of where New York and California were the most egregious examples of that. We are looking at a couple of other states now as well. But that's where we started this, is just what states' standards actually go completely against what we're required to teach here in Oklahoma. And again, so we'll kind of build off of that, but we're looking at, you know, any state that would have those type of standards that would go against on the standards that we have here in Oklahoma.
And this article from Redline also says and mentions that you unveiled new history standards earlier this year that require students to analyze discrepancies and issues relating to elections and graphs and security risks of mail-in ballots. The curriculum also highlights the Bible's influence on the founding fathers, as well as various stories from Scripture. We've talked about that together previously on this show, and that prompted a lawsuit to block the standards because they promote Christianity. Where is that lawsuit at right now? And I really hope you win it.
Oh, I appreciate that. Well, it just got dismissed last week. They tried to issue a stay. They lost initially. They appealed it. They tried to put a stay on the standards to stop them, and that stay was dismissed. So it's not, you know, completely over, but they didn't stop the standards from going into place. We feel really great about it. But it just shows you, Jenna, the lengths that the teachers' union will go to. They don't want your kids to know that the Bible and Christianity played a major role in American history. They fight it tooth and nail to try to secularize American history, to try to go in and teach kids that there's no you know, religious underpinnings to the country. There's no Judeo-Christian values, and that is a lie. They want to lie to your kids so that they can twist whatever they want into our history and turn them into little Marxists. And so, you know, we're going to continue to hold the line on that. It's just clear from a reading of history. That's what I try to tell people. Go, this isn't me saying it. Just go read the primary source documents. And that's what we want kids to do. Go read the documents. You know, determine it for yourself. Find a love for history. Find a love for this country. Go read what they said. It's very obvious what they believe. And again, you know, it doesn't matter if it offends the left. That's our history. And so our kids we're going to make sure that they know it here in Oklahoma.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's the exact same contrast that I saw when I went through law school, was how it was just teaching, you know, what the Supreme Court said the Constitution said. And I was going, well, wait a minute, that doesn't go with what I know from American history, because I was homeschooled. I had a great education from my parents, like what you're trying to give to students in Oklahoma as well. And so I went and read the founding documents for myself and ended up writing my book, The Legal Basis for a Moral Constitution, because if you end up reading the actual documents, the Declaration, the Constitution, the Federalist Papers that advanced the ratification of the Constitution in its original form, then you can't help but come away with the understanding that not only is America founded on a Judeo-Christian premise, but that we acknowledge our rights come from God, our Creator, not our government, and the sole purpose of government is to preserve and protect those rights. And in order to have great American patriots and preserve that Republican form of government, as Ryan Walters was talking about, you have to educate children on that topic, and you have to raise them up in the truth and just the truth of with history. So Ryan Walters, thanks so much for this. I'm always so excited to talk to you because you're just doing such a great job in Oklahoma. Follow Ryan Walters at Ryan Walters underscore on X, and continue to just affirm him in standing firm on this. We love it. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. I want you to picture this. Her name is Kayla. She is 17, alone, terrified, and pregnant. Sitting in a clinic, tears blurring, thinking abortion is her only option. Until she was offered a free ultrasound, paid for by a hero just like you. The moment Kayla heard her baby's heartbeat, the decision was made. And today, her little baby boy, Gabriel, is thriving because preborn walked with Kayla every step of the way. Now multiply that by 38,000. That's how many babies preborn has helped save just this year. How many mothers preborn has come alongside with practical and spiritual resources to make motherhood possible. But here's the most important thing you will hear today. Their goal is to save 70,000 babies by the end of the year. And they can't do that without us. Every $28 provides that ultrasound, the moment everything changes. Will you be the reason the next Kayla chooses life? The reason Gabriel fulfills his destiny? To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or donate securely at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, President Trump is calling out the UK on a new law that threatens free speech on online platforms. But no one is really talking about how this law is actually the framework for laws proposed right here in the United States under the guise of, quote unquote, protecting kids online. So this story coming from Yahoo News, the White House now has warned Sir Keir Starmer to stop threatening American tech companies amid mounting backlash over Britain's online safety law. Members of Donald Trump's administration are monitoring the Online Safety Act with great interest and concern after key allies said that it was censoring free speech and imposing unfair burdens on U.S. businesses. The law, which regulates speech online, allows the British government to levy massive fines on companies like Apple, Truth Social, and X if it finds that rules on hate speech have been broken. So let's welcome in Patrick Hedger, who is the NetChoice Director of Policy. And Patrick, this definitely seems to run afoul of the U.S. Constitution and American law. So what are we doing about it?
And it's great to see that the White House is pushing back on the United Kingdom on this and pushing back also on the European Union that has similar versions of this type of regulation. Unfortunately, we've seen this rule, this type of regulation also introduced at the state and federal level here in the United States. So it's important that we stay vigilant. We all want to keep our kids safe online, but just because the title of that regulation is keeping kids safe online, it doesn't mean it doesn't have these negative unintended consequences such as we're seeing in the United Kingdom.
Yeah. And just because an act or a law is titled something and its proponents say, well, this is the purpose, doesn't at all mean that that's actually what the law is designed to do or what it actually would do when it's implemented. But you mentioned that this act is similar to some that are even being introduced here on the federal and state level as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the most prominent one is so in the United Kingdom, you have the Online Safety Act, and introduced at the federal level here is the Kids Online Safety Act. And it's very similar. It requires companies to go after what the government deems to be, quote unquote, harmful content, and also, in a sense, essentially force companies to institute age verification as well. And, you know, some of these things sound good on the surface, but the devil is really in the details. And what we're seeing in the United Kingdom is age verification means you have to upload your ID to use very basic services on the internet. And that is a huge violation of privacy. And it's a huge cybersecurity risk as well. We just saw a major news story a couple weeks ago about a new app that was breached, and tens of thousands of people's personal IDs were uploaded to a database, and that database was breached, and they created a map of the users. So these are real huge concerns in cybersecurity trade-offs, though. We got to be careful to have these knee-jerk reactions to trying to keep kids safe online.
Yeah, and so this, to me, Patrick, poses two similar but separate problems. I mean, if we have these laws being introduced by legislators in our own government on the federal and state level, that's really alarming, and we definitely need to push back against that. But then also, if the UK passes its own law, how that might affect America and our online platforms, and how, you know, we really don't have any authority other than, you know, obviously President Trump is trying to push back on that. But let's start there. If the United Kingdom passes this law, how might America be affected, and how can we legally push back on this? And would this come through our government or more through the tech companies that are affected?
Yeah, so I think that it's most important for the White House to continue to do what it's doing, pushing back on this statute, which has been enacted. We're already seeing the negative consequences in the United Kingdom, where people are essentially not logging on to certain websites because they don't want to compromise their privacy. And then you have other websites that are shutting down because they don't want to deal with the liability that's associated with this. So it's a huge chilling effect on speech. And it amounts to essentially a tax on American companies, where you're not able to expand into global markets like the United Kingdom. And that's a huge problem. I mean, it's effectively the president's talking a lot about American access to foreign markets in his trade talks. And these are huge. Talk about a non-tariff barrier is a regulation that prevents people from using American websites in a country because it's so onerous and so privacy intrusive. So the main avenue here is for the U.S. government to be pushing back. Because ultimately, you know, we see over and over again, foreign courts rule for foreign governments, not for American companies.
Yeah. And there's also reports that the UK authorities are even threatening jail to U.S. citizens for online posts. I mean, this is a serious risk that somehow a person in the United States that's subject to our jurisdiction and our laws goes and posts something on social media with the understanding of, you know, First Amendment protections, all of this, and then somehow the UK is threatening extradition and jail to U.S. citizens. I mean, that just sounds insane.
Yeah. It is. It's crazy. And it tells you the value of the First Amendment here in the United States. But it's also important to understand that the type of speech that they are targeting is speech that is perfectly lawful here in the United States for the most part. I mean, everybody agrees that there are certain types of harmful content that you have to be able to go after, right? Non-consensual sexual imagery and things like that. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is things that the UK government has deemed under a broad umbrella of what is potentially harmful, particularly harmful to children. But that is such a subjective standard. And unfortunately, that language has creeped into legislation we've seen introduced here in the United States. The Kids Online Safety Act, the U.S. version of what the UK is dealing with right now, would designate the FTC to create a new office, a new bureau, essentially, where they would determine the types of content that is quote-unquote harmful. That's not a decision government should be making. That's a decision parents should be making.
Yeah, well said. And I'm speaking with Patrick Hedger, who is the director of policy for NetChoice, and we're talking about these really insane laws from the UK that are trying to impact free speech here in America, but that America also has some issues with our own laws that are mimicking these in the UK. And so there's also been a report that House Judiciary Chairman Jim Jordan found documents in his investigation that UK authorities have tried to censor a public debate online about immigration, criticism of itself or the UK's government, et cetera. I mean, these are totalitarian sort of tyrannical tactics. And it should be that America leads the way on pushing back against this.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right about that. And notice the mission creep there. Because what the British officials are out saying is that this law is about protecting kids. We're protecting children. And if you use a VPN or any other means to try and get around this, you're going to hurt kids. But meanwhile, they're going after political dissent. That's how quickly these laws that are proposed under very noble intent of trying to protect kids. Everybody wants to protect kids. We're not debating that. What we're debating is what government does with the power that you give them to accomplish that mission. And what we're seeing in the United Kingdom is they right away turned it into a way to stifle dissent on political issues. And so this is not about what kids are seeing. This is about what they want their citizens seeing. And that's what's really scary.
Yeah, and this is how, and I think you described it perfectly as mission creep, and it's also a pretext to say, well, you know, no one should be against protecting kids online. Like, how could you not vote for something like this? But really, then they turn it around and use that to be a broad net to catch the people they actually want, which aren't perpetrators against kids. They really want to catch people that are saying things against their own government, political views that they don't want expressed, and so the threat. As we mentioned, the second part of this, Patrick, is that the threat is here in the United States as well. And this UK Online Safety Act is actually being used as the blueprint for bills that are popping up here in the United States under the guise of protecting kids. You mentioned that there are a few states that have these copycat laws. And how are these being challenged so far by conservatives? I know that NetChoice has been really urging states and the constituency to get involved, because this isn't something that mainstream media is really talking about right now.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen different versions of these, and NetChoice has filed litigation against various versions of these. Again, everybody agrees on the title of these bills, right? We want kids to be protected, but when it creeps into, you have to show an ID to go on YouTube or do a Google search, or there's potential to create a new state board that determines what is and what is not harmful content to minors, or government trying to redesign websites. That really is pushing up against and going beyond what the First Amendment allows. And so it's really important to look at the details of these bills. And a lot of them, you would expect, if you were passing a bill to keep kids safe online, you'd see resources for law enforcement. You'd see provisions to try and educate parents on where parental controls exist. That's not in any of these bills. These bills are about empowering the trial bar to essentially sue websites and then also create these new government bureaus that determine what makes these websites liable for potential lawsuits. No resources for law enforcement to actually go after the bad guys. So that's the really key differentiating factor that we see, and that's what sets off our alarm bells.
Yeah, and NetChoice a couple weeks ago filed an emergency application to the U.S. Supreme Court urging the justices to reinstate your preliminary injunction against Mississippi's ID for speech law. This is HB 1126. And according to your press release, the law violates First Amendment rights while manufacturing a cybersecurity nightmare for families that want to use social media. So it requires surrender of personal information to access fully protected online speech, including things, of course, that would be religious freedom protected. I mean, this just sounds very dystopian to say that you'd have to surrender your ID before you could just go online and do a simple search.
Yeah, absolutely. And lots of people say, well, we don't want kids seeing bad things online. We don't want kids seeing pornography. This is not what this is about. This is about speech that is legal for everybody. They are trying to require you to show an ID to get on Nextdoor and talk to your neighbors, get on Facebook and talk to your community, get on Instagram and look at recipe videos. That's what we're talking about here. Speech that is legal for everyone, including children. And so to have to show that an ID, that creates a cybersecurity nightmare. We saw an app that was launched a couple weeks ago called T. It was a sort of a social media site for women to be able to discuss, and warn each other about potentially bad dates that they've been on, problematic men in their community, whatever. They forced women to upload IDs in order to prove that they were women. So it was a female-only community. That database got breached. And if you create that requirement for every other type of app or website, regardless of its purpose, you are creating a honeypot for hackers. And that is a huge problem. And it's a First Amendment problem as well, because that creates a deterrent for people engaging in lawful online speech.
Yeah, and this is just wild, because you wouldn't have to be forced to show an ID, you know, back in the day if you opened, you know, the World Book Encyclopedia. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, my parents had the entire set on the bookshelf and everything. And if we wanted to go and look something up, you know, for school or whatever purpose, I didn't have to go and give the government my private information in order to access educational resources. Or, you know, if my mom wanted to open, you know, a Taste of Home magazine and look for a recipe, she didn't have to give her personal information over to the government. And so it seems like then we're creating this requirement that we have to give over personal information just in order to exercise some of our basic freedoms.
Yeah, and the big problem here is again, you'll be the pushback on this is somebody will say, well, don't you want to protect kids? There's awful stuff on the internet. Totally agree. We want to protect kids. There is bad stuff on the internet. But the type of legal regimes they are creating behind these laws creates such a huge level of risk and liability that you basically upend the internet as we know it. You make it very difficult to operate websites where people can just post without their post first being reviewed by a moderator, right? So, open forum blogs essentially start to go away. We're seeing that in the United Kingdom, where websites about very benign topics, right, hiking communities and things like that, have just said, "Well, we can't afford the risk here. We're going to shut down." And that is a huge First Amendment problem when you have websites that are shutting down because of a new regulation. It's a chilling effect on speech, and it's especially a big problem when the state has not done everything it can within its constitutional means to achieve its goal first. Right, which is, again, about educating parents, educating students about how to keep themselves safe online and how to access the existing parental controls instead of the government trying to just turn them all on for you.
And I'm speaking with Patrick Hedger. You can follow him on X at @Pat_Hedger, H-E-D-G-E-R, and also NetChoice at NetChoice. And Pat, in just the last few minutes we have, where should listeners be going in Mississippi and also across the nation for Congress to encourage their legislators to vote no on these really dangerous bills?
Yeah, absolutely. So just get in touch with your state officials, because laws like this relating to new technologies like AI continue to crop up. We saw 1,000 different AI bills in the last year, so there's a pretty good chance there's a bad one in your state. And so getting in touch with your state legislators, senators, and representatives, and also calling your federal representatives and senators and educating them about what's – and encouraging them to really look into the details of COSA, which is, again, the American version of what we're seeing in the United Kingdom, which is the Online Safety Act.
All right. Well, Patrick Hedger, thanks so much for this really important briefing, basically, on protecting our freedom of speech. And, you know, in the new digital age, the internet and especially places like X, Truth Social, are really the printing press for America. And we want to ensure that we have access to these platforms that are unrestricted in ways that violate our constitutionally protected rights. Of course, we want to keep kids safe on the internet. That's primarily the parents' job and responsibility. And we don't want the government to issue these kind of pretext sort of authorizations so that will quell our freedoms that we are legitimately exercising. So again, follow NetChoice at NetChoice so that you can be informed about these issues. And of course, we always talk about them here on American Family Radio. And we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, according to reports, President Donald Trump is considering deploying up to 1,000 National Guard troops to Washington, D.C., with an announcement possibly as early as today amid calling for law and order to be restored with all of the crime going on in Washington, D.C. So let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel for the Lawfare Project and one of our favorite legal commentators here on the show. So, Gerard, with all this talk of federalizing the law enforcement in D.C. What are President Trump's options, and do you think he'll actually deploy the National Guard?
Well, he certainly has quite a few options, and we've already seen him exercise one of them, which is direct increased enforcement by federal authorities of federal crime in Washington, D.C. That's the sort of thing that actually makes a difference, because in D.C. and in many cities where you have progressive prosecutors and policing, a lot of crimes don't get charged and don't get noticed. So this is already making has the potential for making a difference. What he can also do and is likely to do, I think, is to call in the National Guard. In D.C., it's a unique situation because the nature of D.C., President Trump actually has direct control under Title 32 of the D.C. Guard. So he can do that, and he can use that for law enforcement without violating the Posse Comitatus Act. So he does have a lot of things that he can do right now.
And I think, you know, personally, I think he should exercise those. I mean, when you have those who are responsible and they are completely derelict in their duty to provide security and law and order, then why not use his authority to come in? And that, you know, gets us to our next story, which we're still following the derelict Democrats in the state of Texas. And Attorney General Ken Paxton has filed his lawsuit against the Democrat runaways, as he calls it, in his press release in the Supreme Court of Texas to secure order declaring their seats vacant. So do you think under Texas law and under the circumstances here, we'll get a favorable ruling to Republicans out of the Texas Supreme Court?
Well, you can. The issue there is that the Democrats do have the Democrats that are failing to do their duty. They really do have a constitutional argument, which is that they're exercising their speech rights in not showing up. Now, I don't know how far that will carry them. I think that might get them sympathy to some extent from some judges. But when you look at what their duty is and what they were elected to do, simply not showing up and refusing to perform the duties of their office. Remember, that's essentially what they're doing. It's they're making a statement, but in so doing, they're refusing to carry out their jobs, which is what the voters elected them to do. So I do think ultimately the governor does have a very good legal argument that this means that they're not willing to perform their jobs and their seats should be vacated.
Yeah. And I mean, it does make sense, both sides of this argument, to say, well, you know, for the Democrats to say, well, we're vacating our seats. We're not showing up, rather. You know, they're not admitting they're vacating their seats, but we're not showing up because this is a statement. But at the same time, does that constitutionally protected, perhaps, speech and that demonstration basically override the duty and the obligation of showing up and ensuring that business can be done in the House? Because if they just simply don't show up, then the state of Texas is basically without a legislature. They're without a House right now. And so it would seem just without the politics involved and you know, which side is doing what, it would seem like that's not a an exception to their duty to show up and provide the quorum in order to get business done.
Well, I think that's right. And I think ultimately the courts will find that there is that First Amendment right on the floor of the House in the performance of their duties. They have the privilege and immunity to say what they will as legislators, but there is no privilege to not do your job. And when you look at the way that this issue is framed, now, we already know that there is authority for the Speaker of the House to issue, you know, to make that request, to issue warrants, to bring back legislators who fail to appear. When you have that in your rules, that means that the system is set up to require attendance. And requiring attendance means that you have to put aside this notion that your fleeing is speech somehow. It's actual conduct. And you can do whatever you want. You can raise objections. You can make statements on the floor of the House. But the rules are set up so that you have to show up and provide that quorum and do your duty as an elected official. So I think ultimately the courts will side with Governor Paxton and vacate these seats. But again, that's also setting it up for years of appeal. So this is not going to be a quick resolution by any means.
Yeah, yeah. And this is kind of a really interesting lawsuit and an interesting view. I mean, and obviously Texas has had this before, and everybody's referring, you know, back to 2021 when Democrats fled the state. Ultimately, there were really no consequences for that. But now the FBI is getting involved and saying, you know, that they're going to arrest and help Texas, you know, round up these Democrats, bring them back to the state. And then I've seen on social media, you know, some other Democrat sympathizers who are in some of these various states saying, you know, hey, we'll shield you and, you know, we'll provide a house for you if you want to come stay here and basically flee law enforcement. Do you think there's any collateral penalties for people who may be aiding and abetting some of these Democrats who are fleeing, like, for example, Governor Pritzker?
Realistically, I don't think there will be. I think that the analysis here is the governor is trying, what the governor is doing and going to the FBI is saying that there is bribery, that there is a violation of criminal law that requires the help of the federal government in bringing back, in executing these warrants. But the flip side argument to that is that people who are supporting these elected officials, it's no different than campaigning, than contributing to a campaign. And that's certainly not illegal. So I think there are plenty of arguments to be made that people who are helping them in the sense of providing them with contributions or donations don't risk criminal penalty. On the other hand, if you are harboring in your house someone who is actively evading arrest, that's a different story. So we may have some law enforcement crossover into that. But for merely providing funds, I think the stronger argument is that it's not bribery, but it's a well-meaning campaign effort by the people donating the money.
Interesting. And I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, who's senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. And Attorney General Paxton mm-hmm. did also launch an investigation specifically into mm-hmm. Powered by the People and Texas Majority PAC. And this is coming from his press release, for potentially operating an illegal financial influence scheme to bribe Democrats into breaking quorum. And so is that a little bit different posture? Or do you think that that type of investigation, kind of under a similar rationale as you were just articulating, mm-hmm. that probably, you know, this type of contribution isn't necessarily under the whole bribery banner?
These are difficult claims to make, in part because you need to have that quid pro quo. You need to prove that these legislators were actually influenced by the money and didn't already intend to do what they were doing. So merely supporting someone who is breaking the law, as they understand it, is a different category than conspiring with someone to actually break the law. So I think that's what makes it tough, is because you have the burden of proving that but for these two PACs, but for the influence of outsiders, these elected officials would actually have sat down and held a quorum and voted. And that's very difficult to prove.
Yeah. And so practically speaking, though, I mean, if the Supreme Court of Texas doesn't go ahead and vacate these seats and say, you have to show up and fulfill your duty as an elected official, then what would this mean for the minority parties in any state from just wielding that power and saying, OK, then collectively, as long as we have a minority that if we all left wouldn't allow for quorum, then everybody would just start doing this, and then that would be the effective weapon to wield against the majority to say, well, if you're going to vote us out of what we want, then we just won't show up and nobody can get any business done anymore.
Well, it's certainly a slippery slope if that's what starts happening. And I would bet good money that right now in pretty much every state, the minority parties are looking at the rules carefully to see, you know, what the law says, what the rules of parliament say, whether they can get away with replicating that in their state. I think Texas so far has been more of an exception and not a leader in states doing so. But there is that concern that in many states now, the people in minority positions will be looking carefully at the rules to see if they can get away with breaking quorum and avoiding consequences when they avoid difficult political choices. And again, this isn't what government is. Government, you're electing people to make those hard choices, to compromise, to object, to govern, not to run away and to bog down government and basically make it impossible to govern.
Right, exactly. And so is there a possibility, perhaps, that that Texas and other states then could contemplate amending their rules of quorum to anticipate this kind of walkout and say, if, you know, members of just one party are absent purposefully to break quorum, then that's an exception. And as long as we have, you know, of the remaining seats, you know, a quorum of those members, then we can conduct business. I mean, would that be something that could potentially be possible?
I think you will see more states looking carefully at the rules and strengthening them to prevent this type of walkout. It's one thing to obstruct business. It's one thing to have, you know, a filibuster on the Senate floor, for example, but that's within the rules. So I think we will see a lot of states contemplating rule changes to make sure that their legislators actually perform their jobs. And at the end of the day, the people who are most being harmed by this in Texas are Hispanics. because the issue is the coalition voting districts, the coalition groups. And one of the reasons why you're looking at redistricting to begin with is that a lot of Hispanics who have started voting more and more Republican, they don't have their votes counted. So ultimately, this stunt by the Democrats is affecting the voting of a minority group. And in other states, they're starting to people are starting to take notice.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I mean, and those are things, of course, that the Democrats are never going to say. I mean, they some of them in their press conferences have said, you know, our constituents want us to fight and all of this. But a lot of it is on kind of the optics and not actually what's going on and the legislation and the rationale that they're preventing. And, you know, Gavin Newsom from California is weighing in and saying, you know, this is tyrannical and all of those things. And, you know, it's just because the majority doesn't like how they're voting and can't control their vote. And I mean, I replied on social media and said, no, the Democrats are preventing anybody from voting. They can vote however they want on the floor. Nobody's dictating that. It's that they're preventing any votes from even happening. But let's turn to one last topic in the last few minutes I have with you, Jared Folletti, my special guest this morning. You can follow him on X. He's a senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. This is coming from Trending Politics. Vice President Vance expects, in his own words, apparently, several arrests in the Russian collusion probe. So Vice President J.D. Vance hinted that the Trump administration's rapidly intensifying investigations into the origins of the Russia collusion hoax will result in, quote, a lot of people facing indictments. So that seems to be a little overly optimistic. What do you think?
I agree with you. I do think that's a little overly optimistic. I think the biggest challenge with any indictment, with any case here, is the statute of limitations, because unless there's an ongoing conspiracy, and it is a little bit difficult to make that claim that the conspiracy is ongoing. We might have a separate conspiracy for a cover-up, but the conspiracy itself ended when Trump won or lost, as you want to look at it. So it's really difficult to see how the statute of limitations would allow a lot of the prosecutions to go forward. But nevertheless, I mean, that's what these grand juries are for. That's what these investigations are for, to figure out what happened. And if there are charges that can be brought, then, yeah, I think we may actually see an arrest or two. But the viability of the charges is questionable to begin with.
And what about all of these subpoenas that have been issued by the House Oversight Committee and, you know, some very notable names, like, you know, Hillary Clinton and others, you know, Mueller himself coming in and testifying? If there's a determination that the statute of limitations prohibits any sort of indictment, would they still be able to just take the Fifth and not provide any information to the House Oversight Committee? Or would that kind of change the posture there and we may at least get some transparency?
Well, I think we can fairly expect them to plead the Fifth, even if most statute of limitations are run. The reason that this is being articulated as a treasonous conspiracy, of course, is that there is no statute of limitations on treason. But that's also very hard to prove, much harder than obstruction, much harder than you know, providing false statements to the government, which have shorter statute of limitations. So there is still the specter of criminal prosecution, and you will still see people pleading the Fifth Amendment, and when they're not saying "I plead the Fifth," they will be making statements that basically are going to deny everything or say that everything that they did was justified.
And, you know, I think just in terms of transparency and accountability, this is frustrating to a lot of Americans who are watching, you know, all of this and saying, okay, well, so what, the statute of limitations is run, and just because politics or whatever the reason, some of these bad actors aren't held accountable. And, you know, we're seeing things in the same context. Meanwhile, there's been a lot of Lawfare against conservatives, Christians, Trump himself, you know, up in New York, all of those things. And there's no real accountability for anyone. Might there be some for Letitia James with some of these investigations?
Well, I think for Letitia James, the irony is that she seems to have dug herself in by claiming to be a local resident of a different state that she was residing in order to get favorable mortgage rates. I think that is pretty much a clear-cut crime if it's provable, if the facts end up being what they are. So she will find accountability for lying, for committing some form of fraud. But that gives us the satisfaction of seeing that someone who claimed the moral high ground is not in fact the person entitled to claim the moral high ground. Ultimately, all of this shows us that we need to be careful who we elect, that we need to be mindful that even jobs like prosecutors, we need to be wary and scrutinize their records because we don't want more lawfare that's carrying down our country.
Well said, Gerard Folletti. Always appreciate your commentary. That's all the time we have for Jenna Ellis in the morning. We'll be back tomorrow. But as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Faith, family, freedom. American Family Radio.
If God could speak, what would he say?
The Bible subjects itself to historical verification.
He says, "We saw this."
We go to the Bible wanting to hear what the living God has to say to us.
When God speaks, what does he say?
The God who speaks. Visit stream.afa.net.
This is American Family Radio, a listener-supported ministry of the American Family Association.
American Family News, I'm Rusty Pugh. President Donald Trump's week will culminate in a high-stakes summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska, where the two leaders are expected to discuss the war in Ukraine and the broader state of U.S.-Russia relations on the global stage. Republican Congressman Russell Fry of South Carolina goes over what the carrot and stick will be during the talks.
Well, I think the carrot is, right, a ceasefire of proportions that allow things to kind of cool down for a little bit. The stick are the economic pressures. Obviously, President Trump recognizes that Russia has been fueling their war machine through oil and natural gas.
When she's not making TikTok videos, Texas Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett is usually...
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.